Welcome to the Keys of the Kingdom with Brother Gregory of His Holy Church.
Well, welcome to Keys of the Kingdom. I'm Brother Gregory, and again, we're going to be talking about the Kingdom of God, and we're going to be looking at Genesis 47. We went through 46 last week, and at the end of that particular chapter, and of course, we have to realize these chapters are divisions that men have put in there. I don't believe that originally Moses put in the chapter links and chapter names and the subheadings that we have at Preparing You. That's something we put in to kind of organize people's examination of the text. And, you know, there's a lot of controversy around the text in some places. Other people are, you know, they read the Bible and they think, well, I'm reading the Bible, or I'm King James only, or they want NIV, or they want this translation or that translation. And they're looking at a history that's 2,000, 3,000 plus years old. Genesis, of course, goes way back to Adam and Eve and creation. And some people are adamant about interpreting the timeline of creation. 6,000 years ago, etc., that's it. And to some degree, there is a way to look at creation from that point of view, but when people begin to miss the message in arguing over the details and the names and the different interpretations, then there's a problem. But when we're delving into these chapters and looking at the different contexts, we try to, you know, look at the Hebrew words that are in the text, because, you know, when I first was reading some of these things, I started looking up in your, you know, Strong's Concordance or Thayer's, you know, what word is that there, and that they're translating this way. And I was shocked to find out that one single word in the Hebrew or even in the Greek would be translated 4, 5, 6, 7 different ways, and that there were sometimes 3, 4, 5 different Greek words that would be translated into the same English word sometimes, and sometimes it would be translated into a different word. And I thought, like, why can't we come to an agreement? What does this word actually mean? Well, then when I began to study in depth Hebrew and discovered that they would say, you know, like a particular word was lakchoke, which is 2706 in your Strong's, and it is translated statute, but sometimes it's translated ordinance, sometimes it's translated decree, sometimes do, sometimes law, sometimes portion, so and several other ways, same word. But then when I actually started examining the Hebrew text, I found out that that same word, which should be chet kuf, was actually, the letters would be, and of course it's from another Hebrew word that is a double kuf, chet double kuf. And then I began to study double letters. Why double letters in Hebrew? And double letters usually mean something when you find them. And so I've done a study on all the double letters that show up. And the reality is that you can find words in the original text that will have, they'll say that it's this word over here, and they'll give it a Strong's number. But occasionally you'll find it with a double letter in it. And why the double letter all of a sudden? Why do sometimes they put 2 or 3 letters at the beginning? Sometimes they reverse the order of the letter and give it this of the word, the letters in the word, and give it the same Strong's number. We're relying, you know, Strong's is a great tool, Thayer's is a great tool, but even Thayer's admitted that he discovered a great deal about the language long after he put together Thayer's as a source of, you know, finding out what words mean, because we're discovering stuff all the time. And Hebrew can become, or seemingly become, very complex if we were to give a different number to every arrangement of letters for a given word, because there would be thousands and thousands of more words in the Hebrew language with different numbers. But the reality is that in Hebrew, the letters have a meaning, and they add a letter, they take away a letter, they double up a letter, and the author is trying to tell us something. But ultimately, there should be no confusion about what is actually being said, what the message of the Bible is, if when we sit down to study it, review it, read it, we sit down with the Holy Spirit. And that's the way the book is written. And you'll hear us make references to that many, many different times. And we're going to be looking, you know, when we were finishing up chapter 46, we see in verse 31, "And Joseph said unto his brethren and unto his father's house, I will go up and show Pharaoh." Now, is that a redundant statement? He says unto his brethren, that's his brothers, and unto his father's house. Is that two different ideas? They may be overlapping, but why include "and unto his father's house"? To the whole household, which includes more than just his brothers, which I guess it would include sisters-in-laws and children, etc. And it would actually include servants, which may be unnamed. When they say that there, you know, 70 some odd go to Egypt, did they bring servants? Did they have servants? They clearly had men working for them. If we read the story, Abraham had lots of men working for him. He had was able to put together, 900 armed men from his own household. Well, those aren't all his kids. Those are his servants. So there may be a lot of people involved. And of course, when they get to Egypt, their children are going to marry. Are they only marrying their cousins? Are they marrying some of the daughters of their servants? You know, how are these relationships perpetuated? It just does not give us all the details. But to think that only 70-odd men and women came to Egypt when Jacob came to Egypt with his whole family, it doesn't really make sense. It doesn't fit in with the rest of the narrative. It actually, and we can find this in several other chapters of Genesis, where they refer to the family members as the key people coming, because servants of the household were a part of the household. They were like family members, but not bloodline family members. They might become family members if, like I said, if a son married the daughter of one of the servants, which happens. Biology happens. And it is very clear that they didn't just marry their cousins. There were interactions with other, and we've already seen that Joseph married an Egyptian, and specifically the daughter of an Egyptian priest. Later on, we'll see Aaron knows the arts of the temple. Aaron is associated with priests from the very beginning. When they call upon Aaron to be a spokesman for Moses, who is somehow slow of speech, we're not sure exactly what that means, but Aaron was not. And so was Aaron a part of the priesthood? Well, this may be important in this next chapter, 47. Did some of the people that were the descendants of Joseph and Jacob, who was known as Israel, were some of them priests in Egypt. And of course, we're going to see them settling in Goshen, which it goes on in the end of chapter 47, where Joseph said unto his brethren and to his father's house, I will go up and show Pharaoh and say unto him, my brethren and my father's house, which were in the land of Canaan, are come unto me. So that was repeated twice, brethren and his father's house. And the men are shepherds, for their trade hath been to feed cattle. And they have brought their flocks and their herds and all that they have. And it shall come to pass, when Pharaoh shall call you, he's saying to his brothers, and shall say, what is your occupation? What ye shall say, thy servants, uses a particular word there for servants, trade hath been about cattle from our youth even until now, both we and also our fathers, that ye may dwell in the land of Goshen. For every shepherd is an abomination unto the Egyptians. So somehow or other, if we're following that as a logical reason, they're going to be in Goshen because Egyptians consider shepherds an abomination. So they're going to be over here. But also, Joseph sees it as important that they remain shepherds, that they remain keepers of flocks in Goshen, that is somewhat isolated or separated from the regular Egyptians. It's not a part of the regular Egyptian system. And, you know, where Goshen is, and is that Avaris, as we've talked about in our study of Exodus. Why that particular area? What's the lay of the land? They grow a lot of grain there. Of course, they still have the floods of the Nile, but is this a part of the same aqueduct system that we see that was early in Egypt, which allowed them to cultivate the land of Egypt, this tropical area that depended on these floods that came down the Nile River, and then they channeled the water so they could grow these crops, which made them, you know, the deserts round about them gave them a certain amount of protection. They had access to the sea through the Nile. They had this source of water that came regularly, except for the fact that Joseph, listening to the Holy Spirit through dreams and his understanding that was unique amongst his own family and amongst the world, according to the way the Pharaoh looked upon Joseph, that Joseph was able to say that we're going to have 7 good years. Lots of grain will be grown, way more than we need. We could ship it all away, or we could store it up. And the Pharaoh listened to Joseph and stored it up. You know, when I was working on wheat farms in North Dakota years ago, there was grain silos on every farm, and there was a sticker on the silos, said property of the federal government. The grain inside. Now the silos actually belonged to the ranchers and farmers. They had built them themselves. Some were out of wood. Some were out of these round ones of steel. Some actually had the big, huge, tall silos, because they were on the railroad, and they would buy grain and ship it out and load it onto railroad cars. But on these silos on my uncle's farm, it said property of the federal government, the grain was. And what he had done is he had sold the grain at the going rate at that particular year. Some of his grain he would sell to the federal government and store it for the federal government. And he would sell what he needed to sell to pay his bills that year. A very frugal farmer, a lot of old machinery, great mechanic, and he farmed with a lot of older equipment that he just kept in constant repair, and he was not in debt. And so he paid his bills with some of the grain, but in the good years he stored the excess. And yet he got paid for that amount, theoretically, as a loan from the government. Small interest, low interest loan from the government. And only he could buy it back from the government at any given year. If he had a crop that failed, I've seen hail come through and just devastate a crop, smash every single blade to the ground so he couldn't even harvest. I've seen the snow come early and cover up his harvest of flax, which he was going to harvest for the seed. And he just had to plow it all back into the ground again and lost that all. But if he got no crop in a given year, he could buy, usually if he got no crop, a lot of other people got no crop and the price would rise. And he could buy back that grain for what he paid plus that small interest and sell it on the market and make a profit because the market went up. And this kept the market from fluctuating too much and also allowed 7 years supply of grain on the farm for America all the time. Every year, any given year, whether we had a drought like the Dust Bowl or anything like that, this, of course, is back in the 60s, there would be no famine in America because the grain was stored in silos all over the United States on farms from Texas to North Dakota. And though that program is gone. That's not being done anymore. Now you don't have that reserve anymore in America because your government does not know Joseph. It does not know the Holy Spirit. It does not know of the dangers of not having a reserve. And they've changed the nature of the relationship of government to agriculture over the last 50, 60 years. And people are oblivious to this. I'm not, because I've worked in both sectors. I know people. And hopefully, I also, when I sit down and read the Bible and read the news and read what's on X or read what's in the media, I sit down and read it with the Holy Spirit. And I made some remarkable discoveries this morning, but it's not the topic of today's show. Maybe we'll do an X broadcast and discuss some of the things that I saw this morning. But we're going to continue in this, that they're going to be settling in Goshen, and they're going to stay herdsmen because Joseph knows the future. He sees way beyond what most people see when they look out their window or look out their door or look into the media of today. And so we're going to get right into this 47 because it starts right up. And of course, there's not a real chapter break in the original text, but it starts right up. Then Joseph came and told Pharaoh what he just said in chapter 47 he was going to tell him, and said, "My father and my brethren and their flocks and their herds and all that they have are come out of the land of Canaan, and behold, they are in the land of Goshen." And he took some of his brethren, some, even five men, and presented them unto the Pharaoh. And the Pharaoh said unto his brethren, What is your occupation? Now, is this a standard question they all ask? Or are they telling us in the text that Joseph knew what the Pharaoh would ask? Because he could see it in the future. I don't know. You could speculate either way. They don't specifically say, but according to the story, he knew exactly what the Pharaoh was going to ask. And why? Well, you can guess on your own, or maybe you can ask the Holy Spirit and find out. So, if you're asking the real Holy Spirit. And they said unto Pharaoh, thy servants are shepherds, both we and also our fathers. Exactly what Joseph had told them to say. And we see him talk about our fathers. And we see this particular word, Ob, that's used in the text. Even the word occupation in the text is different than, you know, the normal word for occupation is mem, ayin, shin, hey. But here in this text, we see mem, ayin, shin, yod, kaf, mem. So what is your occupation had three extra letters added to it in the text. Is there a meaning in that? Well, we're not going to have time to go into that right now. But even the word servant that we find there in the text, you know, your normal word for servant is in biet delet. That would be the normal Hebrew word for servant. But in this text, we see in biet delet. Again, yod, kaf. So they're adding this yod and kaf again in the text. The first one, they added yod, kaf, mem, and the word servant, they said yod, kaf. Yod stands for the divine spark. And the letter kaf, which we discuss at preparing you, we tell you the meaning of these words, as also has a particular meaning. And you put these meanings together, and it enriches, it doesn't change, it's still the word servant, but it enriches what Moses is trying to tell us about these events with Joseph. And he says, they are shepherds. And we, and also our fathers. And again, like I said, the word father there normally in Hebrew is Ab. But in this case, we see Ab, be it. Vav, Tav, Yod, Nun, Vav. And there's a reason for, I mean, why the Vav, Tav, Yod, Nun, Vav? Well, Tav is the word for faith. Yod is, again, the divine spark. So they're telling us more. But we're going to get into this in a little bit more depth. I don't want to turn it into a Hebrew lesson, but there's a lot to the chapter 47. We'll be right back. Well, welcome back. So we're in this chapter 47, and Pharaoh asks, what is their occupation? And they say that they are shepherds. And of course, there's, what does that mean to be a shepherd, to be a herdsman? I'm a herdsman. I'm a shepherd. Actually, with real live sheep and cattle. So I have a little bit of insight into it. When I first came out to do that, this wasn't what I was raised in. My father was an attorney. My grandfather was a doctor. But when I came out to the desert and started learning what it meant to raise cattle, raise sheep, and to be a shepherd and herdsman of livestock, I did a lot of things the old way, the ancient ways. Just to learn it, just to go through the actual process of doing it. And then, of course, you know, it was going back and then reading, you know, Psalms 23 and finding out, you know, what it meant to be a shepherd meant more when I read it. I always remember picking up a book. I actually bought it, one of the few books I bought new in a store. Usually I get them in a thrift store or somebody mails them to me. And The book was Abraham was the name of it, and I read the first page, and they were crossing a river, and the author writes, when they came to the river with the sheep jumped into the deepest part of the river, as sheep will do. Well, I can guarantee you that ain't true. Sheep do not want to get into water. They do not want to jump into the deepest part of water. And if the water is moving, they don't want to go anywhere near it. Because sheep drown very easily. I know of a case in our own valley where 1,000 sheep drowned in Summer Lake. And the only one who survived was the goat they had with it. And he walked back. What they did is they ran out on the ice. And the shepherds sent the dogs out to get them to come back, which is a huge mistake. What they should have done was go out there with hay and along the shoreline, start dropping hay, and the sheep would have come all along. But when the dogs went out out on the ice of Summer Lake, the sheep all bundled up in a tight group and broke the ice. The concentration of weight broke the ice, and they fell through into the ice. And the goat that was with them probably led them out there. That's why you put a goat with a herd. Walked back across their floating bodies because it wasn't very deep, but it was deep enough to drown them. And the goat survived. But the reality is that there's a lot of lessons to be learned by actually going through and understanding what is going on here. And of course, the reason the brethren have been brought to Egypt through circumstances and through the insight that Joseph had was they had a lot to learn because they didn't know what it meant to be Israel. Jacob had learned this, but the sons did not know what it meant to be Israel. Many people today do not know what it means to be Israel. What are the lessons you have to learn to actually be Israel? Because Israel's not just a bloodline. It's a way. Like Christianity is not a corporate faith. It's a way. That's what Christianity was called. The way. It was the way of Christ. And the way of Christ is the way of Israel. But most people don't know what that is. And the brethren did not know at this time. So they were going to sojourn. And that's what we see in the next line. They said, moreover, unto Pharaoh, for to sojourn in the land are we come. For thy servants have no pasture for their flocks. For the famine is sore in the land of Canaan. Now, therefore, we pray thee, let thy servants dwell in the land of Goshen. And so they're asking to dwell in the land of Goshen so that they could sojourn there. Well, it's interesting if you, we're not going to go into detail on it, but that word sojourn is Gimel, Vav, Resh, normally that's the base of the word, and it is translated sojourn most of the time, but you know, maybe 20% of the time it's translated dwell, but it's also translated afraid and stranger and gather together and assemble and abide. So it's translated a lot of different ways. Well, in the same sentence we see the word dwell in the land of Goshen. But guess what? That word, dwell in the land of Goshen, is not the same word that we see translated sojourn, even though sojourn is sometimes translated dwell. Now, the word that we see translated dwell is yod, shin, beit. Beit has to do with household. That's what that letter means. Yod, again, is the divine spark. And you can look up these words yourself and find out what each individual letter means. If you go to Preparing You, can look up our page on Hebrew, and we show you, you know, kind of a basic rundown of what these, the concepts associated with these letters. And that word is translated dwell probably 50% of the time. It's also translated inhabit or inhabitant or sit. That's a very common way it's translated. 170 some odd times it's translated sit. Abide, inhabit, down, remain, tarry, lots of different ways. But it has this same idea to it, and of course it has that letter B it. But the other word for sojourn doesn't have the letter B it in it. So it actually means something quite different. And of course, with flocks, you don't live in one place normally. You move around, because you have to move your flocks, especially in the desert, you have to move your flocks to another graze. And so you travel with your flocks. So sojourn has a little bit more of that idea. But we're going to take a look at this whole idea of even having cattle, because everybody's going to lose their cattle here in this whole episode with the famine, because they're not very far into the famine yet. And there's a lot of years that they're going to cover, and they're going to talk about it in this chapter. So the Pharaoh spake unto Joseph, saying, thy father and thy brethren are come unto thee, and the land of Egypt is before thee. In the best of the land make thy father and brethren to dwell. And that's that word, you know, that has the be it in it, the yod be it, to live and dwell in the best of the land of Goshen. Let them dwell. He goes on to say, if thou knowest any man of activity among them, then make them rulers over my cattle. So he wants to hire them to take care of his cattle. And because they probably know the business, and there's a lot to the business of raising sheep and cattle. When he says cattle, it could even mean sheep. So evidently he has some cattle. But even the word ruler there, there's a lot of words that are translated in ruler. Some, basically the word is shin-resh. And sometimes you see it shin-resh-resh, which again is that double letter. Shin-resh-resh means a lot more than just shin-resh. And resh has to do with authority, and shin has to do with position. So anyway, they're going to be rulers over cattle. Do they ever become rulers over Egyptians? Are they given power and authority to take care of other things? Well, we'll have to examine that in other chapters later to find out. In verse 7, it goes on to say, and Joseph brought in Jacob his father and set him before Pharaoh. And Jacob blessed Pharaoh. Now, if we go back, and we will go back and earlier when Jacob flees his own brother Esau and gets tangled up with Laban, and Laban wants him to stay there because he knows there's a blessing on Jacob, that whatever Jacob touches will be successful, because he's received the blessing of Isaac, which comes down as a blessing from Abraham, who received his blessing from Melchizedek, which are all topics in themselves. But they use a particular word here for blessing, and of course it again has more letters. Vav, Yad, Beit, Resh, Kuf. Again. So they're bringing in this idea of Pharaoh wanting this blessing and needing this blessing actually makes a difference. And Pharaoh said unto Jacob, how old art thou? So this is the first question. Jacob is blessing him, and he asks something, encourages him to ask, "How old art thou?" And Jacob said unto Pharaoh, "The days of the years of my pilgrimage are 130 years. Few and evil have the days of the years of my life been, and have not attained unto the days of the years of the life of my fathers, in the days of their pilgrimage." Abraham lived a long time. Melchizedek lived a long, long time. But the lifespan of people was a lot shorter at that time. To find somebody 130 years old, that's a big deal. They were surprised. And we don't know what kind of condition Jacob is in. But he's making these long journeys. And he's 130 years old. And the Pharaoh knows there's something special about this guy. Of course, this same Pharaoh knew there was something special about Joseph. And Jacob blessed Pharaoh and went out from before Pharaoh. So this whole idea of blessing somebody, and it actually carries some weight. It's not just, you know, like a Hallmark card, was well accepted. The same as a person could be cursed. Remember a previous Pharaoh, not with the same kind of power that this Pharaoh is going to end up with, but a previous Pharaoh in Egypt had taken the sister of Abraham. And the sister of Abraham happened to be his wife. It had different mothers, but same father. And boils broke out in their family. A disease erupted because they had done something unknowingly. They had taken her and they had paid him for her, and they thought it was a good deal, but it was forbidden to take another man's wife. And Abraham had not told him. And he even referred to, "You have cursed me because you did not tell me the truth, Abraham." So Abraham was not without flaws himself. But the whole story of Abraham, which we'll go through eventually, is him learning what it means to follow God, which is really what it means to be Israel. And of course, after we go through Abraham and Isaac and find out how Jacob became Israel, we know that it is absolutely essential that the sons of Jacob learn to follow God and the way of God, or they will not be Israel. They will just be the sons of Jacob, but not Israel. And this is why they're being brought into this bondage. There's a lot of reasons. We can look at it from the point of view that Reuben says, "This curse has come upon us because we would not hear the cries of our brother." And so that's an important element, because the counter distinction to that is, if you're going to be Israel, you have to hear the cries of your brother, and even the cries of your cousins, and the cries of your neighbor. If you will not, there will be a recompense that will come upon you. A destruction, a captivity, a plague, because you're not really doing what Jacob did to become Israel. And again, like I said, when we go through those chapters, we'll look at that in greater detail, and hopefully it'll be revealing to people. But I don't really think that people will understand or see it unless they sit down and listen with the Holy Spirit. So we see in verse 11, "And Joseph placed his father and his brethren and gave them a possession." And there's a particular word there that is translated possession almost, I think, every time in the Bible. It's in the Bible more than 60 times. It's the word akuza, Aleph, Chet, Zan, Hey, I believe is the normal letters that you find there in that chapter 11 for possession in the land of Egypt, in the best of the land, in the land of Ramesses, as Pharaoh had commanded. And Joseph nourished his father and his brethren and all his father's household with bread according to their families. So now they weren't going to have to buy the grain, they were going to get the grain, but that's going to be explained in greater detail as the famine continues. Because what happened in Egypt happened in Canaan and many areas all around. There were all kinds of people who came into Egypt or came to Egypt to buy grain. And as we see in verse 13, and there was no bread in all the land, for the famine was very sore, so that the land of Egypt and all the land of Canaan fainted by reason of the famine. And Joseph gathered up all the money that was found in the land of Egypt and in the land of Canaan for the corn, for the grain, which they bought. And Joseph brought the money into Pharaoh's house. And actually, you know, if you study the treasuries of Egypt, there's often a reference to two treasuries. And there would be somebody, a vizier, who would be put over two treasuries. One is the house of Pharaoh, but there's another treasury that is not the house of Pharaoh. Actually is cared for by the temple, by the religion, by the priests. And as in our study on Sumer and the turtle dove goddess and the welfare, the table that should have been for your welfare but is a snare, there is another system out there. All these religions were the social safety nets, the welfare systems of these different governments of Sumer, of Nimrod in Babylon. They had a social safety net that was run through the temples. Even when we look in Rome, they talk about temples, all kinds, you know, Temple of Saturn, Temple of Dionysus, Temple of Ephesus, all these different, even the Temple of Jerusalem, we've done a show on that, where when the Romans sacked Jerusalem, at that time, according to archaeologists, the temple was a bank. And they took all the gold out of the bank and took it to Rome. And they spent the gold to build the Colosseum that we can now see in Rome. That came out of a bank called the Temple of Jerusalem in Jerusalem. Well, that temple, why is the temple a bank? Because it is the central controlled social welfare system of Judea at that time. Now that, where was the bank in the days that Moses was following the tabernacle? They tried to create a bank, a central treasury. That's what the golden calf was. It was a central treasury. You know, they didn't have it all in gold bars or gold coins and carried around in chests. It'd be too easy to pilfer some of those out. We'll see that. How would you counterfeit money? And we'll talk a little bit about that. But they put it all into one statue. And in many of the Greek city-states, they had similar statues. You know, golden calves or certain goddesses or certain people, they would make these golden calves. And these were reserve funds. They actually called them, if you translate the Greek, it's called a reserve fund. And occasionally they sawed off an arm or a leg and melted it down, make coins to fight for the war effort. Because it was a depository, a central treasury. If you don't understand that that's what the golden calf was, but what did Moses, where did he want you to put your gold? Your central treasury. Well, he didn't want you to have a central treasury. He wanted the gold in your purse and the silver in your purse. And a lot of times people would carry it, they'd make rings out of the gold. Sometimes those rings would look like a coin with a little tiny hole in it. Sometimes it would look more like a ring you could put on your finger, but they'd put something through it, and that's how they kept track of it. You know, even if they put it in a purse, they might have a string through all the gold, through a hole in the gold, so that in case there was a hole in the purse, it's not going to all fall out. You know, they're not going to lose one. It's just an extra way. But it's in your purse. It's not centralized. Because if you centralize your wealth, you're centralizing power. That's not the way Israel is to operate. It's not the way the kingdom of God is to operate. Jesus is very clear about that. Don't put your gold in a central treasury. Put it in your pocket. But gather together in love and take care of one another through faith, hope, and charity. The Temple of Sumer did not operate according to faith, hope, and charity. The temple in Babylon with Nimrod did not operate by faith, hope, and charity. And the temple in Egypt would not be operating by faith, hope, and charity anymore, because now all the money from all around, all the gold and silver was going into these two treasuries of the house of Pharaoh and the temple. And it says in verse 15, and when money failed in the land of Egypt and in the land of Canaan, all the Egyptians came unto Joseph and said, give us bread, for why should we die in thy presence? For the money faileth. So this word money, kesef, is the Hebrew word that we see in the text. And it means, generally speaking, silver. There was gold involved also, but it's precious metal. That it was some form of money, shekel, some sort of metal, substance. That's what the money was. But now it's all in the treasury. So what are the people going to use for money? What are they going to use from now on? Well, they're going to have to go. Of course, there was a wide system of barter at that time, that you could trade goods for other goods. You know, I mean, if you had sheep, you could make things out of wool and trade them for things that you know, like grain. Maybe because you were moving, you couldn't grow grain. So you would trade for people who were more sedentary and growing grain. And you said, well, we're going to give you wool blankets. We're going to give you a wool hat. or maybe if you had cattle, you would make leather. And you would trade the leather goods for, you know, whatever it is that you didn't produce. And, of course, the guy who was a miner who mined silver and gold, he would trade his silver and gold for things, and he might turn them into coin. That's where the first coins were made in Germany, were made by a silver miner, and a weight of a piece of silver was called a dollar, and that's where the word comes from, that we now use to refer to a dollar. Except for today, most people, if you say a dollar, they're not thinking of a silver dollar, they're thinking of something else. So what did they use in Egypt when the money failed? The word faileth there actually means ended. They ran out. Everybody ran out of gold and silver and money because this famine just kept going. And we'll take a look at that and get into that as we continue with this chapter. In verse 16, we see, and Joseph said, give your cattle, and I will give you for your cattle if money faileth. So now he was going to start trading for barter money, which is cattle, sheep, objects. And we'll see more of that as we come back to Keys of the Kingdom. Well, welcome back. So we see the money failing in Egypt during this famine, because what they mean is ending. That the word there actually means coming to an end. They're running out. And it wasn't that they didn't have a depression, and then suddenly, you know, they weren't having inflation. They were actually having deflation, because as the money began to run out, for a lot of people, that money was worth more. But it wasn't running out for the Pharaoh. It was increasing for the Pharaoh. Now, there's no evidence that I have come across that the Pharaoh was jacking up the price of grain. He was doing a fair job, because Joseph is in charge of this, so I have to imagine that they were selling the grain for fair market value. But there was just less money to use to buy it. So if you wanted to go to Egypt and buy grain and bring it back to Canaan, it is likely that some people sold things that they had in Canaan to get the money, if they didn't have a lot of money in their purse, and take that to Egypt, because, you know, maybe you made your living by building houses. You're not going to carry the house to to Egypt, but you can sell your house and bring the money to Egypt, because it's portable wealth. More portable than many other forms of wealth. And the whole history of money, if you go back to ancient Egypt, and you go back to many other ancient civilizations, a lot of times people did not have coinage and silver and gold in circulation, at least too much. Although we've uncovered a lot of graves in the last 50, 60 years that... some are just very old graves, and we find the people inside them, and you know, where they've hollowed out a cave, or they actually built a cave by piling up stones in places of Great Britain, and the people that are buried there, obviously a king or a prince or somebody who was very wealthy, they bury them with all kinds of gold ornaments, silver ornaments, precious stones, etc. And but so that gold was around, and of course a ring, a piece of jewelry could be used as money as well, and those things are more likely to survive. But there was a commodity money also during these early days. You know, like I said, if you were a shepherd, you could trade for meat. You could trade, if you're a cattleman, you could trade for meat or hides. You could trade for wool. You could manufacture something with those raw materials, you know, and, you know, a saddle or what have you. And it was worth more. But everything was used as what they call commodity money. Grain, oil. Or you could mix the grain and oil and bake bread. And now the bread was more valuable than the grain by itself, because you've put more labor into it. So the bread can become a commodity as well. Every commodity from beer to bricks was allowed for purchases of present value. You gave this object and you got that object. And if you go back to you know, Leviticus 19:36, just balances, just weights, just ephah, and just hin shall ye have. I am the Lord your God, which brought you out of the land of Egypt. So in Leviticus we see that it's very important to have just balances and weights. In other words, you're actually trading substance for substance. You know, when they talk about a pig and a poke, is what that is. You got a pig in a cage, and it's all dark, and you can't even see the pig. And you poke a stick in, you hear the pig squeal, and you say, okay, I know there's a pig in there. I know he's alive, because I just poked him, and I heard him squeal. But you don't know how fat he is. You don't know how healthy he is. You don't know if he's covered with sores. You don't know if he's got a broken leg. So they say you don't buy a pig in a poke. You want to see what you're buying is honestly there. The same as you don't want counterfeit money. You don't want, you know, you buy a horse and you think it's 3 years old. They tell you it's 3 years old. You find out it's 30 years old. Well, you've been robbed, because it's not just exchange. But there's, if you go to, you know, Bouvier's Law Dictionary, you actually, there's a maxim, on that the es justum medium, which the whole thing translates, money is a just medium and measure of commutable things, for by the medium of money, a convenient and just estimation of all things is made. So we talk about things worth $10. You know, like a gold coin was called a $20 gold coin. That meant it was worth 20 ounces of silver, because an ounce of silver was a dollar of silver. So a $20 gold coin wasn't $20, which is a measure of weight. It was stamping on that coin that it was worth 20 silver dollars. That's, now you're minting a value on it. Because today, an ounce of gold is worth way more than $20. Actually, an ounce of gold, I think, is over $3,000 an ounce. But, of course, they're weighing it not against silver dollars. Now, if we went and figured out the value of a silver dollar, how many silver dollars is worth it? Of course, that's why back in the 70s, I think it was, the United States started minting a $50 gold piece. But then there's a whole issue there. Is it the same thing? And we're going to get into that. We want to keep moving along here so that we can get an idea of this. But we have these footnotes on our website at Preparing You in Chapter 47. But one of the things that is very important, there's a case, Stanek versus White. It's a Minnesota case, but it's been upheld by the Supreme Court, quoted by the Supreme Court over and over and over again, that there's a distinction between a debt discharged and a debt paid. When discharged, the debt still exists, though divested of its character as a legal obligation during the operation of the discharge. Something of the original vitality of the debt continues to exist, which may be transferred even though the transferee takes it subject to its disability incident to the discharge. It goes on from there. We have the whole text, or at least the pertinent text, on the website. We may refer back to it. Most people aren't even following that. The point is that it's in natural law for tens of thousands of years, according to historical records, that you, when you buy something and you promise to pay, is not the same thing as actually making the exchange of the just weights and measures. It's very important that people understand that. That if, you know, if I say, well, I'll give you 10 sacks of grain for that dairy cow, but I don't have the grain now, but in the harvest, when I have a harvest, I will give you 10 sacks of grain for that dairy cow. And you say, but I'd like the dairy cow now because I need the milk now. And they give you the milk cow. On your promise to give 10 sacks of real grain in the harvest, and you milk the cow, and you maybe you don't feed it well, maybe it gets skinny, and maybe even the cow in your care gets sick and dies because you don't take care of it. And then when the grain comes to harvest, you're hailed out. Or maybe you sell all your grain to somebody else, and the guy comes to get his 10 sacks of grain. You say, I don't have it. I can't give you the 10 sacks of grain. Well, you give me back the dairy cow. Oh, I don't have that either. It died. Well, you took all the milk and you let the cow die and you don't give me the grain. Guess what? You're in debt to that man. He can take his pound of flesh from you, so to speak. And so you don't want to be in that position. So it's very important that natural law, what later became called common law, that you actually make payment. And over again in the Bible, they talk about pledge and not pledge, that you you don't buy anything with a promise. But you may get to use the cow, but you still have to fulfill the promise. But an element of that promise remains. So why am I bringing this up now? Because this is one of the key understandings that should come to everybody. But most people are completely oblivious to it because they don't know how things work in reality. Remember those blessings that Joseph had, that Jacob gave, that these are built in to nature. That those that operate according to the spiritual laws of creation will reap the blessings of creation. But those who violate the spiritual laws, the quantum laws of the nature of creation, there will be a recompense. It will come back and haunt you. And we'll explain that in greater detail. But the reference is important because it's important to understand. The money is failing. As we've seen in several verses, they repeated this over and over again. And in verse 17, and they brought their cattle unto Joseph, and Joseph gave them bread in exchange for horses and for the flocks and for the cattle of the herds and for the asses, and he fed them with bread for all their cattle for that year. And when that year was ended, again, that's the same word that we see faileth. actually, it's not 100% actually the same word, because there are more letters added to it. The word for faileth is basically the single word tav mem. But in this case, when he said ended, he uses the letters vav, tav, tav, mem, where there's this double tav, which means that this ending is really coming to an end. It's in spiritually and physically coming to an end. They came unto him a second year and said unto him, we will not hide it from the Lord how that our money is spent. And that word is that same word for faileth, but that is only tav mem. My Lord also hath our herds of cattle. There is not aught left in the sight of my Lord but our bodies and our lands. So now some of these people actually own land in Egypt, and they were out of food. And the only one who had, they couldn't eat their cattle. They couldn't eat their flocks. They only have one thing left to trade, and that's their bodies. And the word for bodies is, you know, it's a particular Hebrew word that is not a very long word. It's very, it's gimel, vav, hey, or at least from that word. Sometimes it's gimel, vav, yod, hey. But in this case, we see gimel, vav, yod, tav, nun, vav. Well, they're adding ideas to this. They're realizing that they've got nothing left. They're standing before the Pharaoh, standing before Joseph, and they've got nothing left. But they're right to their land that they've proved up. They farmed maybe for generations after generations and actually owned in Egypt, not by government suffrage, but because their ancestors lived on that land. That's all they got left. So in verse 19 it says, wherefore shall we die before thine eyes, both we and our lands? Because if they're not there to work the land and spread the water and plant the seeds, the land will die and turn to desert and blow away. So what is their response from that question? Buy us and our land for bread, and we and our land will be servants unto the Pharaoh. Their land will be servants unto the Pharaoh. And it says, and give us seed that we may live and not die. Because Next year, they may want to plant their seed in the land and then water it up when the waters come, if the waters come, so that they don't die and so that the land does not become desolate, is actually the words they say. And the land be not desolate, turn back to desert. And Joseph bought all the land of Egypt for the Pharaoh. For the Egyptians sold every man his field because of the famine prevailed over them. So the land became Pharaoh's. So now Pharaoh owns the land. And verse 21, and as for the people, he removes them to the cities from one end of the borders of Egypt even to the other end thereof. And I'll give you a brief insight here. We'll look at verse 22. Only the land of the priests bought he not, for the priests had a portion assigned them of the Pharaoh and did eat their portion which the Pharaoh gave them, wherefore they sold not their lands. Everybody else sold their lands. But the Pharaoh did not. Now what land would this... briefly touch on this, we'll come back to it. What land did Abraham own? He was a wanderer, Hebrew, wanderer, following his flocks across empty desert grounds, you know, arid areas. What land did he own? He did own land. Well, he owned a tomb, a grave. And even to this day, cemeteries cannot be taxed by the government. Pharaoh did not tax. Rome did not tax cemeteries. Cemeteries are been known around the world. We'll give you 100 stories on this. The early Christians, where'd they meet? The catacombs in the cemeteries. That because they could meet and talk kingdom business in a cemetery, and they couldn't be accused of treason or speaking against the Pharaoh, or speaking against Caesar, because they were in the cemetery, and that land was sacred. Even the kings cannot tax the cemetery. And this is going to play out if we want to really understand what Jacob is going to request and what why Abraham bought the cemetery plot of Abraham and Jacob. They offered to give it to him for free, but he says, no. I got to pay for it. I got to actually pay for the land. So anyway, back to this idea of money. Like I say, there was a commodity money. It was much later where gold and silver was started to be used, and sometimes it was just gold nuggets, silver nuggets. Then they learned to melt them down. And I think they knew about it thousands and thousands of years ago, but in some areas you see the primitive actual nuggets surviving, and they used that as money. But very quickly people knew how to, it's pretty easy to melt down silver and gold and require a coke furnace like steel or something, and they made coins out of it. And they did the same in Egypt. They had gold and silver and even copper coins. A copper coin was called a deben, and one deben was about half an ounce of copper. But all this was running out. It was all ending up in the hands of the Pharaoh, and there was no money to even buy, so they traded their cattle. So what did the people use this money? Well, we see archaeologists have found it in Mesopotamia, in parts of Egypt, in the tombs. In Egypt, they find these scarabs with etchings on them that look like numbers. Sometimes they're made out of stone, but often made out of baked clay. This was used as a means of exchange. Some people refer to them as dirty money, because if they're made out of clay, they're dirt money, clay money. But sometimes they're made out of carved stones, etc., depending on their denomination, because the money failed. So they had these other things that they used besides, you know, a sack of grain. It was a method of accounting. You know, instead of filling out, I owe you 10 bags of grain, they would give these scarabs or these little clay things that would consider to have the value of 10 bags of grain. And then you would come back and redeem them for the grain later. And so it was easier, more easily transported. And of course, we do the same thing today, but we use paper notes, and we have very tough paper that isn't like papyrus that can easily crumble. And we've coined money, but we've taken all the gold and silver out. And of course, we've given you a lot of that history. Rome did the same thing. And we have links on the page where you can look up Temple of Diana, the Ephesus, and the Temple of Moneta. One of those temples in Rome, you know, Juno Moneta, the god of Juno Moneta. But so what, did people go in there and sit at the altar and pray to Juno Moneta? Is that what, and they had these big congregational meetings of all those people that I go to the temple of Juno Moneta to say my prayers? No, it was the mint. That's what the temple of Moneta was. It minted coins. And you could bring your gold bullion in or your gold ore in, and you say, I'd like you to make me 1,000 coins. Caesars did it all the time because a lot of the gold was in their hands. But private parties could come there, and they would mint it, and they'd take a portion of the gold and payment. But it was a business. But they still called it the Temple of Juno Moneta. It wasn't superstitious. It was the mint. That's where we get the word Moneta, is where we get the word mint. Because that's what they did there. And if you don't understand that, you don't understand what was going on in the Bible, in the New Testament, the Old Testament. Because this is about survival. It wasn't superstition. It was actually real things were going on. So ask the question now, we just read it. The people were removed to the cities. Okay, how are they going to plant seeds on their farm if they're living in the cities? The land now belongs to the Pharaoh. He's going to have somebody work that farm. And he just moved all the people to the city? No, the people didn't move to a city. People still lived on their farm. They still lived on their land. But now they're under a civil authority. They don't have lawful title to their land. Their land belongs to Egypt. It doesn't belong to them. It belongs to the Pharaoh, to the government. Their labor doesn't belong to them. It belongs to the government. All of their labor or just a portion of it? Well, we'll see that in the next verses. Verse 23. Then Joseph said unto the people, Behold, I have bought you this day and your land for Pharaoh. Lo, here is seed for you, and ye shall sow the land. So they're not living in the cities. They're living on the land. They're going to plant their crops. But they're now doing it under a civil authority. What is civil law? Civil law is the law that men make for themselves. How do you make the law for yourself? You make contracts, covenants, and constitutions. You make agreements. And you sign them under penalty of perjury. And you take the benefit of those agreements. And it consummates the agreement. And as the United Nations is fond of saying, pacta servanda sunt, one of the most... When I looked up that phrase the first time to find out the history of that phrase, it means agreements must be kept. Almost everywhere I found it was in papers that were out of the United Nations. It was that of all the places I found that, because it's a famous saying, it's a maxim of law, agreements must be kept. I found it in the United Nations. I don't know if they're good at keeping their agreements, but they're going to hold you to any agreements you might have with them or the New World Order or the United States or Australia or whatever government you have made agreements with to get your daily bread. Because if you go get your daily bread at the tables of governments, at the civil tables of governments, they will make requirements upon you. And they probably already have them written up in their statutes. But you will be snared. That's what David says. And Paul quotes David. There is a table that should be for your welfare, but is actually a snare and a trap. David says that. Paul says that in the New Testament. So what table are you? Are you eating at the table of Pharaoh or not? Because what's going to happen is, verse 23, then Joseph said unto the people, behold, I have bought you this day and your land for Pharaoh. Lo, here is seed for you, and ye shall sow that land, and it shall come to pass in the increase that ye shall give a fifth part unto Pharaoh. But we'll continue this when we come back to Keys to the Kingdom. So welcome back. So we see that all the people of Egypt, all the people of Canaan, their lands and their labor was now going to be belonging, or at least a portion of it, was going to be belonging to the Pharaoh. And we see in that verse 24, he says, and it shall come to pass in the increase when you get your harvest, that ye shall give the fifth part unto the Pharaoh, and four parts shall be your own, for seed of the field, and for your food, and for them of your household, and for food for your little ones. So what that in essence is in that verse 24 is they were now going to have to pay 20% of their labor, the products, the produce, the commodities of 20% of their labor to Pharaoh, because they didn't own the land and they didn't own 100% of their labor. A portion of their labor was now going to belong to the Pharaoh. And this deal was set up by Joseph. And I always thought it was amazing when I was first studying this stuff 30 years ago, 40 years ago, 50 years ago, I came across income tax in Egypt was 20%. Still to this day, under Mubarak, income tax was 20%, which is one-fifth. You know, you make $10,000, 20% had to go to the president of Egypt, to the government of Egypt. And if you made $1 million, 20%. Had to go. Now, there were probably a lot of other taxes. I can't imagine they didn't. But why still 20%? Because this is the deal set up by Joseph. And they said, thou hast saved our lives. Let us find grace in the sight of my Lord. And we will be the Pharaoh's servants. And Joseph made it a law over the land of Egypt. Unto this day, and unto this day, that's Moses writing, that the Pharaoh should have a fifth part, except the land of the priests only, which became not Pharaoh's. So the priest's land couldn't be taxed. It was tax exempt. The tax excluded, because the priests were separate. They didn't sell their labor. And of course, again, those priests, what were their, if you went to the all the land that the priests had and the temples that all the priests had and everything, what would you find there? Well, of course, there are temples, but you would also find granaries made out of bricks where they piled up grain in these granaries, because grain was like money. It was like wealth. It was like a treasury. But also because this is what religion was. Religion was used to help take care of the needy of society. And that's what we've learned from our study of Nimrod, of Babylon, of Sumer, of the turtle dove goddess. These are the goddesses of welfare. and the care of the people in time, hard times. They would get grain. But Pharaoh had put up grain for himself. He had also given grain to the priests because he was a religious man. And so some of the grain that he produced, he gave to the priests. The priests didn't have to come to him and sell themselves, their labor, nor their land, because he was already donating to the priests. Because the original social welfare systems of almost all societies, from the Teutons, the Romans, everything, was voluntary systems of social welfare. Because this is what brought the people together. This is what created the bonds of the people. Which is why Moses did not want a golden calf, a central bank, where your wealth is going to be in the hands of men who are in charge of the golden calf. And he wanted the gold to be in your purse. But he had altars, and this is why in Leviticus also it tells you that all your offerings at the tables of Moses, the altars of Moses, were to be free will offerings. Because he knew that if you have a nation that does not depend on free will offerings, but forced offerings, you would destroy liberty amongst those people. And when liberty is gone, they'd be back in the captivity, the bondage of Egypt. This is what the bondage of Egypt is a portion of your labor belongs to a central authority. The land you are on, you don't actually own. Your labor doesn't belong entirely to you. You get a portion of it back, but I don't know who made the deal for you. I know what the deal was with Joseph. 80% you get to keep, but that isn't necessarily the deal you're getting from the government of France or the government of Canada or the government of the United States or the government of Australia or the government of Brazil or Colombia. You have some other deal with them. It's not Joseph's deal. And even if you had Joseph's deal, and we went over this in our study of Exodus, which is at Preparing You. You can go back, all the recordings are there. That through crafts of state, they made the 20% grievous. How did they do that? Well, we discussed that there, and you can go back and do those studies on your own. So, you saved our lives. This is a law forever in Egypt. A fifth part, a 20% of your labor and the produce of your land or your business or whatever it is going to belong to the Pharaoh. This is the same as, and it's because you needed to go to that Pharaoh, that government, for your bread, for your daily bread. See, the early Christians, they were kicked out of the social welfare system set up by Herod and the Pharisees because there was leaven in it. Those of you who have been listening know what leaven really is. It's not yeast. It's something else. Very clearly, Jesus said, beware of the leaven of Herod and the Pharisees. Why, do they sell yeast? Do they have bad yeast? No, it's not yeast. It's a metaphor. That's another thing about the Hebrew language. Almost every single word has two meanings. The same exact letters it may be given different Strong's numbers, but it will have different meanings. Same letter combination. Same letters for the reins of a horse or the reins of control over something, the power to control something. Same word is also kidney. And we've explained that. You can look up kidney at Preparing You and find out what that word actually means and why it's important if you're going to understand what Abraham and Isaac and Jacob and Moses was doing and what all the prophets were talking about. So the priests did not become a part of Pharaoh. And Israel dwelt in the land of Egypt in the country of Goshen, and they had possessions therein, and grew and multiplied exceedingly. And Jacob lived in the land of Egypt 17 years. So the whole age of Jacob was 147 years. So 147, what was he before? 130, so there was another 17 years he lived. And then the time drew nigh that Israel must die. See, they call him Jacob in 28, but now they say Israel must die. Why do they switch back and forth? Because Israel is going to die, and the sons are not yet Israel. They're just the sons of Jacob, because they don't know what it means to be Israel. Yeah, I mean, they could call themselves Israel, but they wouldn't really be Israel unless they knew what Jacob learned when he wrestled with the messenger of God. And he called his son Joseph. When he drew nigh, Israel must die, he called his son Joseph and said unto him, if now I have found grace in thy sight, put, I pray thee, thy hand upon my thigh, and deal kindly and truly with me. Bury me not, I pray thee, in Egypt. He didn't want to be buried in Egypt. He wanted to be buried somewhere else. Why? Why is that important? Well, he doesn't own any land in Egypt, but his father's own land somewhere else. Now, to some degree, this is symbolic, but many of the things we do, when you get married and you give your wife a golden ring, the ring is a symbol. With this ring, I do troth. I do trust. I'm going to trust in you to be my wife. And she has to trust in you. But the ring is not the power. It's the symbol. Getting buried in a particular place was a symbol. And he was telling him that something. And Joseph understood. But I will lie with my fathers, and thou shalt carry me out of Egypt and bury me in their burying place. And he said, I will do as thou hast said. So Joseph agreed. And he said, swear unto me. And he swear unto him. And Israel bowed himself upon the bed's head. So this is, there's a message in this. Most people aren't going to get it. I mean, if we go back to Genesis 13:2, and Abraham was very rich in cattle, in silver, in gold. He actually owned it. He owned the cattle. People don't understand the symbiotic relationship of, you know, I mentioned it earlier in this particular show that servants were a part of the household. And they may not be listed by name, but we know they were there because we know that Abraham was able to muster an army of 900 young men out of his household. Well, those aren't his kids. That's his household. This is why the household is more than just the immediate family and brethren, which we've pointed out several times. They're telling you so. Well, cattle are a part of the household. Now, anybody who had cattle in Egypt, it now belonged to the Pharaoh. Unless, of course, they were the priests. They might have had cattle, too. Those cattle belonged to the Pharaoh. But the Pharaoh wasn't going to out there calving and lambing. He was going to give them back to the people. And the people weren't living in the city. They were going to be living back on their land. But they're not taking care of their cattle. Now, of course, he's going to have a Department of Agriculture to count how many cattle you have. Because those are his cattle. How many did I give you? How many are you bringing back? You know, he's going to have, and then he's also going to want to count the people. because a portion of the people belong to him. That portion of their labor, portion of their life belongs to him. Of course, there's a ceiling limit, only 20%. You know, if we read in Genesis 24:35, and the Lord hath blessed my master greatly, and he has become great, and he hath given him flocks and herds and silver and gold and men servants and maid servants and camels and asses. And probably horses. Which is why we saw there in Genesis where he was trading, he was getting their horses too. They were going to belong to the Pharaoh, all this stuff. Genesis 23:16, Abraham hearkened unto Ephron. Abraham weighed to Ephron the silver, which he had named in the audience of the sons of Heth, 400 shekels of silver, current money with the merchants. So they had money then, and he weighed it out because he was going to buy that tomb and own it. He had to exchange present value for present value. Gold, silver are just dirt. They're just land. It's highly refined. You know, like I could go out and collect sand and start plants in that. They're not going to do that good. But if I go out and find a place where there's humus mixed with it, that's more refined soil. That would be a better place to plant your seeds. But gold and silver is just refined land, just weights and measures. Ezra 8:25, and they weighed unto them silver and gold, and the vessels, even the offering of the house of our God, which the king and his counselors and his lord and all Israel present had offered. And again, Exodus 20:23, ye shall not make with me gods of silver, neither shall ye make unto you gods of gold. Well, the word gods there, of course, it doesn't mean Juno Moneta. They're not talking about that. It means ruling judges. Those, that word God means ruling judges. If you give your gold, your silver, into a central treasury, whoever is in charge of that central treasury now has the right to decide what to do with your gold and silver. They are the gods over your gold, because you have one purse. That's where the value, you know, and Proverbs warns to you, you know, in Proverbs 1:14, cast in thy lot among us, let us all have one purse. The golden calf was one purse. You know, Exodus 23:3, and the people break off their golden earrings, which were in their ears, and brought them unto Aaron. They took their gold and they gave it to Aaron, and now it was going to be in this. So what are they going to have for money? They're not going to be able to buy from foreigners with domestic clay scarabs. Whatever they were going to create. But Moses put an end to that right away and said, no, this is a bad idea. You're going to have to return that. And they actually did not return the gold of the golden calf to the people. They turned it into a powder, and the people had to eat it. And that's another whole story. Well, and there's maybe deep significance as to why they had to do it. But even Proverbs 3:9, honor the Lord with thy substance and with thy first fruits of all thine increase. But now your first fruits go to other gods, small g gods, who rule over the people. Tell them what's going to happen with their gold. A lot of people think they're going to go into Fort Knox soon and look and see if the gold is still there. And they say, well, that's our gold. Well, no, it's not your gold. It's the government's gold. I know a lot of people want to think, well, yeah, it's the government of the people, for the people, by the people. But it's only that kind of government if you're in charge of the social welfare. Otherwise, your religion has become the turtle dove goddess of Sumer. And this is why Jesus says, you are not to be like the governments of the Gentiles, who call themselves benefactors, but exercise authority one over the other. Because that's what they did in the temple of Sumer, in the temple of Babylon. They forced the contribution. That was the leaven of Herod and the Pharisees. That they created a system through the civil government of Herod, along with the religious government of the Pharisees, combined the two, left and right hand, of society, where now they could force the contributions of the people. They weren't free will offerings anymore. Now they freely signed up, but they weren't free will offerings anymore. They were forced offerings. They were now men who could exercise authority and make sure that you contributed according to the way they think you should contribute. And they will come in and pace off your crops and count your cumin's branches, and they will force the contributions. That's the table that is a snare and a trap. It will make you merchandise like the people of Egypt became. When they got their bread from the Pharaoh, they bought it first with their money until they had no more money. They couldn't even own gold anymore. And of course, that's what HJR 192, which we mentioned on the page. I'm going to add more links on that page for Genesis 47 at Preparing You. And I've already got hundreds of links to other articles showing you how this all fits together. That if you've now no longer own 100% of your labor, you're in the bondage of Egypt. This is just important, that if a portion of your labor belongs to whatever government you're in, that government is based on the design of the bondage of Egypt. And if your leaders become corrupt, the burden will become greater and greater. The cost of things are not going up. The money, the scarabs, the notes, the dirty money, I'm quoting here from the archaeologist, the dirty money, the filthy lucre. We have that term in the Bible. Maybe that means the same thing. Maybe it comes from the same idea. I'll do a study on that. It's becoming less worth less and less and less. And you're going to be buried in a place where you don't even own the grave, under a mountain of inflation. Now, people have a great deal of hope with their present leaders as we do this show. But unless people realize that legal charity is a covetous practice, and they repent and start seeking the kingdom of God, which operates entirely by free will offerings, rightly dividing the bread from house to house. Unless you go that route, which is the way of Christ, no leader is going to save you. It's just not going to happen, because the laws are already set in motion. And from that, there is no return. So we kind of got to this chapter. There's all kinds more. There's a lot of more links on this. On our side panel, I went through this whole thing of both we and our land, and I actually put the Hebrew words there so that you could see it, and we could talk about those words and the additional added letters. Maybe I'll put in the footnotes so you can see the letters, like, we'll be thy servant. Again, thy servant would just be the two letters. It'd be in, be it. But in the actual text, you see it, be it, deleth, yod, mem, which meant you're not just servants for the day. You're not a day laborer. You're continuously his servants. Mem has to do with his flow. And you will be literally subject to him. The yod, it would be, you would have to listen to him. You don't get to listen to God. He may say, oh no, abortion is good. You have to support that, and you have to continue to support that, because you're a servant in his house. Because you can't, he has now become your divine spark. I have an article on Commander-in-Chief, which I believe covers the executive orders of Bill Clinton, that says that the federal government is his executive order, signed in Scotland, says that... that your supreme authority is the federal government, moral authority. Anyway, thank you. peace on your house, and may God be with you. God bless.
You have been listening to The Keys of the Kingdom with Brother Gregory of His Holy Church. For more information on the educational ministry provided by His Holy Church and Brother Gregory, including services, counseling, lectures, books, and other audio materials, please write to His Church at Summer Lake, Box 10, Summer Lake, Oregon, 97640. You can also find us on the web at www.hisholychurch.net.